Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1000.ES0905, certificate number 42869, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Who controls the British crown? Who keeps the metric system down? We do. We do.
Who leaves Atlantis off the maps?
Who keeps the Martians under wraps?
We do.
Do you have a favorite conspiracy theory? Are you like seduced by ideas, generally that things are controlled from behind the scenes?
My conspiracy theories that I genuinely believe are pretty banal.
Like you explained the popularity of the band The National by virtue of some kind of behind the scenes conspiracy.
Machinations? Probably even more banal than that. Like, I tend to think that the sound meter on sports events, Jumbotrons, mm-hmm. that purports to go up and down green into red as the crowd gets louder, mm-hmm. is fake. It's just a pre-taped graphic and it's not reflecting crowd noise at all.
When the ball game happens at a Mariners game where the hats,
the balls, you know, it's three card Monty with a
three card Monty with hats, or the three speedboats that are racing and
hydrofoil
and,
race.
Yeah. And is it red, green, or yellow? Do you think those are rigged? Or do you think those are actually put into motion there?
I think the hydrofoil game is random and the ball in the hat is real as purported. So I don't think there's a deception there. The last time I was at a Mariners game, I was sitting by a couple Londoners who were literally looking on Wikipedia trying to figure out where the score was. Because at a baseball game, you see RHE, runs, hits, errors. Right. They have no idea what's going on. They're like, did that man...
It's super confusing score? Even to me. What's the score?
But they were the most confused by the hydrofoil Who's race at the end of the fifth or sixth inning. He turned to me and said, now what's this now? Well, these boats are racing on the screen. It has nothing to do with baseball. And he was like, oh, all right then. I guess Championship League football, Premier League football does not have.
No, they're behind. Well, you know, Premier League football at that point in the game would have a giant fist fight.
Right. In real life, not on the screen. The other conspiracy theory I absolutely believe is that those penny crushing machines that make souvenir coins are not actually crushing a coin. They've got pre-squished coins.
No,
and they just take your penny and your quarters and they spit out a pre-squished.
You're old enough to have put coins on a railroad track.
Yes, but I don't believe.
You don't believe that
machine is isomorphic. The railroad track is fake too. While the train is passing and you're not looking,
it's dropping smashed coins.
A train employee is cleverly reaching down and switching.
But so you don't tend to think of global politics as being something that's, if not controlled, at least greatly influenced by cabals or by organized groups of powerful people who are affecting.
I'm skeptical
trends.
In general, for a couple of reasons. One, it's hard to keep a secret.
Boy, I'll tell you what.
You know, like if there really was something good in Area 51, we would know. I think
seems like it would be tough to keep.
You'd have to tell thousands.
There's
of
a lot
contractors.
Of government employees. Yeah.
Yes, and they're bored. They're not actually working most of the day. They have lots of time to email their families and be like, oh, I saw the alien corpse again today.
Yeah, they can't all be sworn to secrecy and be like read into I mean, there are a lot of people there just sweeping the floors, right? I mean, exactly. They can't all
Somebody's
know.
Changing the vending machine right. Cokes right. At Area 51. And I guess the other reason is it just seems like it's so hard to have a global concern. It's just easier not to. Like, I think about this. I think about how the technology to do a 9/11 type attack existed for decades before September 11, 2001.
Right. And all you had to do was use a box cutter to get an airplane.
And yeah. It's
crashing super. Into a building. You never, it's just no one ever thought of it before.
Yes. Like the knife part of it is like literally Bronze Age, Iron Age technology. and it hasn't happened since. And surely there are people who are crazy and evil enough to want to do that. But it's just easier not to. Like, yeah. what a hassle to have to get all these guys, teach them how to like take off in a commercial plane, get all the documentation. You know, what if we just played Call of Duty? You know, and I genuinely right. think the world is full of examples like that, where the massive sinister things we think probably could be happening, but part of the banality of evil is just that the laziness of evil also. Like, it's easier not to have a big, scary conspiracy.
Well, and the simplest explanation is often the truest, right?
Never ascribe to malice what can be chalked up to, what's the incompetence or incompetence. Whatever the thing is.
I mean, as soon as you have more than three people who know a piece of information, it's no longer a secret. And for sure, if you've got groups that involve dozens of high-ranking, rich industrialists, we know that they can't keep secrets any better than anyone else can.
They're doing stupid things all the time. And occasionally they get caught. And that makes you think, hey, if this bozo was flying to his pedophile island all this time and people were winking, does that mean conspiracy theories are true? Because look, this guy really was doing all this stuff and everybody turned a blind eye. Or does it mean, no, this guy eventually got caught. There's no way you could do a moon landing on this scale. I don't know what to think. I tend to think no. I think most conspiracies are made up.
As someone who has spent quite a bit of his online life being in the conspiracy debunker camp, I will warn you that we're going to get plenty of letters, even based on the first 5 minutes of this show, from people who want conspiracies to be true and who have lots and lots and lots and lots of convincing documentation.
I don't want to reduce all these people, but it's easy to see why you would want conspiracy theories to be true. It's a very appealing idea that the reason why the world is such as it is and things are against you in general is because there's a coordinated effort that's out to get you.
It's a very appealing idea, but a particularly modern idea.
Is that right?
Yeah. If you go back to, well, I mean, you're a student of the Bible and of...
I am not.
Of Aquinas and of
for two.
The Greeks, Aristotle.
I've heard of all these books. They sound great.
But if you go back to not just the writings of ancient times, but also the writings of medieval times and the Enlightenment, really, you don't find conspiracy playing a major role in the way the world is described.
Nobody in the Renaissance is like, Columbus faked it all. Columbus faked the whole thing. The New World is a soundstage in Venice.
Because power and politics are pretty nakedly exposed. The king is in charge, and the king said this.
It would be hard for him to keep a secret.
He has, but he also, like, he has a sort of self-interest in keeping things in play, and a lot of the royal families were all related to one another, so it wasn't a secret when this princess married that count what the plan was, what the plot was.
Does that mean when we talk about old-timey conspiracies, star chambers and cabals and gunpowder plots and whatever, like at the time, nobody was like, the king's a figurehead, there's a star chamber making all the rules?
A lot of, you know, there's a lot of it is retroactive conspiracies, because as conspiracies became popular.
Retcons.
Right. As they became popular, they had to be located in documents of the past, in symbolism of the past, ancient truths, right?
Rosicrucians and all the above.
But also conspiracies became more and more popular as the explanation for events became harder and harder to elucidator, harder to understand.
Sure. Like everyone in the world, I cannot explain to you why World War I started,
or how it ended,
yeah, exactly.
Why it ended the way it ended, and it's pretty.
Complexity breeds conspiracy.
Yeah, the American Revolution doesn't have a lot of conspiracy around it because it's pretty clear.
Unless you believe in Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati, John. Like,
but again, those are conspiracies that came.
Yes, those are retcons.
That's right. At the time,
both sides agreed.
Yeah, that it was a taxation without representation.
Here's why we're going to do this.
And so it was the 19th century, really, where things started to become politically complex in Europe, especially. And it was a result of a post-French Revolution, the beginning of a kind of republicanism, the aristocratic class was under siege. Old systems were falling apart. There was industrialization happening.
There were finally multiple powerful parties with competing interests.
And there
the
were
people, the church, the state, the new middle class.
New middle class industrialists who had tremendous power, but complicated allegiances. And also within Central Europe, especially, competing powers that were sort of changing the landscape of Central Europe in a way that was changing sort of who had authority over new populations, old populations. Borders were being transferred.
For example?
In the mid-18th century, the Austrians, the Prussians, and the Russians partitioned between the three of them what had been Poland, Lithuania, and the Duchy of Lithuania / Poland took up most of what we think of as contemporary Poland, the lower half of the Baltics, all the way down to Moldova. And
Moldova's back.
Yeah, that's right. Like all of Central Europe kind of was this very powerful duchy for most of the millennia, or certainly for a large portion of it. And as the power of that nation declined, Russia, Austria, and Prussia moved in and ultimately just decided, let's just split up this whole Central Europe into three quadrants and we'll...
That's not a conspiracy. It's a treaty.
They all did it openly. It's a treaty. It's an invasion. But what was true of that area was that it represented the lion's share of the Jewish population of Central Europe. At that point in time, Russia had almost no Jewish population, or a negligible one. And Germany and Austria too didn't have extensive Jewish population.
Because they were so concentrated right here in the lower Baltics.
Because who were?
The Jewish people.
In Central Europe, it was just kind of like not just the lower Baltics, but Poland and Ukraine. This was the sort of majority population of Jews in them.
Okay.
And so all of a sudden you had big Jewish populations within these pre-existing countries that didn't have prior experience with dealing with this very large minority group. That already there was a lot of, anti-Semitism isn't a new thing.
Nobody likes a minority group. Nobody likes a large, powerful, successful minority group, especially.
Right. But the Jews of Central Europe were not...
I don't want to say nobody likes a minority group. That's harsh. But generally, people are not good at being welcoming.
If you're looking for somebody to not like, why wouldn't it
be
the...
Yeah, pick the safer, smaller one you can beat up. That's how it works.
The Jews of Central Europe were not powerful or rich. They were, typically just a peasant class.
Okay.
But the introduction of Jews into these nations that were also competing for... They were competing on a global scale, and had aristocracies that were beginning to feel the pressure of modernity, and there was a kind of rise of conservatism in politics and government, because post French Revolution there was people are panicked, right?
Retrenchment against the mob.
We have this example of what republicanism can do, but also what it looks like.
And it sure seemed like domino theory, you know, to use Cold War language. Like, this is coming for you next, nobles.
And the revolutions of the mid 19th century that put the fear into all of the nobles of Central Europe, Eastern Europe, because it was, you know, it was only this close.
And they've got to know that, you know, we haven't been treating the peasants great either. When you think about it, guys, let's be honest.
So a retrenchment of conservatism and also an awareness of what probably didn't feel inevitable, but certainly felt like the march of time and progress was delivering this republicanism unto the world. America was ascendant. France, I don't think you could describe as ascendant exactly during the 19th century, but certainly was exporting this new sort of revolutionary intellectualism. Mm-hmm. And during this period, we also have a rise of not just the industrial class, but a lot of migrations of country people to the cities. This is an era where people are leaving behind old crafts and leaving behind an agrarian life and becoming factory workers. And
that's where the jobs are, yeah.
So also during this period, there's too much information for people to take in to explain everything with a thumbnail description. Like, why is it that this revolution failed and this one succeeded? Why is it that, these sort of complicated global relationships now are not, it's not just a simple relationship between the daughter of this prince and the son of that prince. There are kings interacting with democracies. And
if you're a peasant farmer, you still don't care. But increasingly, there's a class of people who are, you know, living in cities, kind of trading stories, reading publications. They're literate now.
That's right.
They can follow these affairs. There's a growing class of people who will start to chatter, and it won't just be gossip about whose daughter got caught doing what in the hay loft anymore, right?
Right.
Like, it might be really juicy geopolitical stuff.
Well, and it coincides with the rise of the popular novel.
Stories.
The rise of the pulp novel, and in particular, the sort of era of the, like this is when Alexandre Dumas is writing The Three Musketeers, right? We have the political novel.
A lot of these novels do have like political skullduggery, right?
That's right.
There's scheming.
There's someone behind a bookcase, and you know, the advisor to the king is whispering in his ear. It's a popular form that is, equivalent to a thriller that didn't really exist prior to this. I mean, outside of stories around a campfire.
People didn't used to get Jaffar'd, but now kings get Jaffar'd.
They get Jaffar'd, whatever that means. What the hell does Jaffar'd mean?
The evil vizier.
Vizier, yes, of course.
There's always evil viziers and cardinals and whatnot.
I haven't seen Aladdin. I know it's a hole in my education.
Wait, you've never seen the cartoon Aladdin?
No.
Holy cow.
I know, right?
This is the conspiracy theory that's going to come out of this.
Look, I've read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, but I haven't seen Aladdin.
Maybe the 10th time you're reading the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, you're like, you know, I should put this down and just watch Aladdin with my daughter.
But there was a very influential sort of novel that was in a kind of popular ancient style, which was a conversation between the dead that was written by a Frenchman by the name of Maurice Joly, who wrote a book called, it's basically like a conversation in hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu.
Ah, I see.
And
fan fiction.
That's right. And what he was trying to do was, you know, the Napoleon III had reestablished the ancien regime or whatever. He had reestablished
the empire
post-Republican. And Maurice Joly, the political climate didn't allow for criticism of Napoleon III overtly. So he wrote this satirical novel where Machiavelli and Montesquieu are debating politics in hell. And
that does sound like hell to me, actually. It's like freshman year of college. Two guys who won't shut up about politics.
It seems really like a fun room in hell, you know, compared to some of the other.
They're having a good time.
Right. I mean, they're just like, it's
a very ineffectual hell if you can just like sit and shoot the bull about politics with celebrities.
I think that there are multiple levels of hell, right? And the ones that are up closer to the fresh air, you know, they probably have coffee.
What? Right. Why is he so convinced that Montesquieu and Machiavelli are damned?
Like, well, that's another good question. But
couldn't they be in heaven? I guess in heaven you wouldn't.
Unlikely.
You wouldn't care about these lower concerns.
Well, and also unlikely that Machiavelli and Montesquieu are in heaven. I don't know. They could be anyway. It was a satirical critique of Napoleon III, mm-hmm. in which Machiavelli is arguing that the way to take control of a population of people, the way to manipulate a population in the masses within the, you know, this modern, within a modern society would be to take control of the press.
Sure. It's the beginning of the information society.
Right. And seed within the press, discontent and certain ideologies.
Send your mom phony Facebook updates.
And make the mass feel like that make it feel self-generating. Mm-hmm. And to replace kings with presidents and with congresses where the leaders are brought up from the mass. They're regular people who then can be controlled and manipulated by.
Yeah.
All you have to do is have...
It's much easier to install a congressman than a king.
That's right. And all you need is one little bit of leverage, one...
Let the record show that John is rubbing his thumb and fingers together.
But not as money, but as an example of like, if you have one wide stance in a public restroom,
sure.
You become manipulatable
using information.
That's right. So all of these kind of methodologies, basically more or less saying that liberalism is the best path to controlling and ultimately like establishing despotism over the mass.
And it's still an open question. Like maybe these guys were onto something in hell.
Well, it's an effective critique and was meant hilariously. Of course, Joly was arrested. Although he published it anonymously, it wasn't hard to find him. But the idea that the principles of democracy and liberalism and ultimately culture are all actually pernicious.
Yeah, they might not be utopian after all.
And that all it is doing is undermining a kind of state of solidity and calm represented by the old masters, right? At least we knew who was in charge. And now everything is potentially undermining the values that kept us whole. After Joly, a writer by the name of Hermann Goetze, who was also kind of trying to write thrillers and adventure stories, arrived on the scene and in 1868 published a novel called Biarritz. And in the course of his Biarritz novel, he quotes / plagiarizes big portions of this conversation between Machiavelli and Montesquieu in hell, but instead quotes it not satirically, takes it and using the exact same phraseology, attributes it to a conversation overheard, you know, a rabbi overheard describing.
Is it specifically a rabbi in this case?
Okay. Because Goetze is an anti-Semite, and this is during a period where anti-Semitism is also as a component of this new disbursement of Jews sort of centrally in Europe.
Into big cities now, I'm guessing.
It's becoming a anti-Semitism is one of these things that ebbs and flows throughout history. And generally, up until this point, it was localized. I mean, there was always a tendency within Germany or in Central Europe to kind of segregate Jews. But then there would be a great period where they were where assimilation was more the project. Jews were integrated into society, mm-hmm. but always kind of kept separate. And then there would be another kind of there would be an event or something, some reason to scapegoat Jewish people. And throughout the whole second millennia after, I mean, any time after the Jews emigrated to Europe and the diaspora happened, you see this kind of ebb and flow.
Is Goethe just like lazy and he needs to fill out a word count, or does he actually believe that these, like, does he think that this is, does he not get that it's a joke, I guess is my question. Does he understand that he's mistaken an onion piece for actual news, which is again something that happens in our modern news cycles?
No, he is stealing it, but he also is attributing it not to Napoleon III, but to what he is kind of sort of positing as the hand behind Napoleon.
So this has got to be malicious. Like, he's got to know that he is adding something new and untrue to the story by passing this off as a Jewish plot.
Well, taking something away from it, which is its context.
Sure.
Yeah. And what's seductive about attributing it to the Jews is that, you know, Jewish people were often relegated to certain professions, mm-hmm. as part of this system of segregation. Money lending was thought of as unclean in a lot of cultures.
Right. Modern prohibitions against usury, right?
Right. And so the whole idea of capital had a kind of, you know, of using capital to invest, banking. As capital became a bigger part of 19th century economic and political policy within Europe, it already had a taint of connection to Jewish life and mm-hmm. bankers, you know, the Rothschilds and whatnot. I mean, they weren't that came out of a segregationist policy, or rather that just like when we talked about the Cagot, carpentry and leather tanning and butchery were things that were relegated to a underclass.
These are beneath us. We don't feel like a good Christian would be charging interest, but we need it to happen. So it's the same thing you see with immigration debates today. We need this labor, but we have to kind of pretend we disapprove of it.
Right. And that extends then sort of spiritually, psychologically to insurance and to real estate investment. Mm-hmm. And you start to see a kind of confusion in the 19th century as craftspeople and skilled labor become less valuable than people just working machines in
because
factories.
Because factory goods can duplicate a lot of their work, right?
Right, and it becomes ancient guilds, ancient talents start to be worth less, and it's the history of capitalism that you can read.
Today they're all gone. Yeah. today there are no guilds or talents.
but also because because there are these newly Jewish populations in these countries. The strangeness of this new world, when you're looking for a reason for how things are getting destabilized in your larger sense of how governments and economies work, mm-hmm. and you're looking around like, what's different? Oh, you know what? There are an awful lot more.
I do see more Jews now.
More Jews around, right. And this was especially true in Russia at the time. Russia having a taken that portion of Poland that had probably the largest concentration of Jews in Europe. Russia, which had a czarist government that was already extremely paranoid, by nature it was paranoid, but increasingly paranoid as the power of the czar started to degrade by the freedom of the serfs and the rise of a kind of rebellious aristocracy there.
Yeah, the czars were not wrong, right. As it turned out.
But that was, the Jews became a convenient scapegoat.
So you see pogroms on both the local and more widespread level.
And a lot of story generation having to do with the fact that the Jews, there's more to the Jews than what we see. And there were a lot of laws that kept, that area of Poland and Lithuania, that central area became what's known as the Pale of Settlement, which there were laws that kept Jews in those areas. And they
Pale meaning boundary, like beyond the pale. I see.
They weren't allowed to emigrate to cities. Oh, okay. You couldn't leave your shtetl and move to Moscow. There were a lot of restrictions on how you could travel. And that wasn't new to Russia. I mean, prior to the partition of Poland, if you were just a Russian, it's not like you could just move freely throughout the country. Mm-hmm. But in particular, the absorption of all these Jewish lands, the Jews within were then very much constricted in how they could move. But if you were a successful Jew, if you were someone who was aristocratic, if you had made money, you were allowed to travel more freely. You could come to the big city. But within Jewish life itself, there was a kind of burgeoning consciousness, a self-consciousness that the Jews were a united people, that they never were fully going to be assimilated into all these nations. There was it was the very early days of Zionism.
What became Zionism?
We are
a people. And
we are a people, and we need to look out for each other. We need to stick up for each other. There was and a lot of this was focused in France, which was a liberal government at the time, where there were notions of equality and fraternity and
liberty, even.
Liberty.
They put it on the flag.
And so the Jewish intellectual consciousness was sort of focused in Paris. Mm-hmm. And a group called the Alliance Israelite Universelle.
The AIU.
That's right. Sort of was founded there to support Jews throughout the world. There was an understanding that, there are all these Jews in North Africa and in Palestine and in Poland.
Before, it would just be your little shtetl, and you would not have a lot of awareness of, you would know the stories of your people, but not the current spread, right?
Right. There's no Rome to the Jews. Yeah. There's no Pope. There's no central authority. And so there wasn't a unified.
I mean, today there's Barbara Streisand, but at the time there wasn't.
And in Paris there in the 1860s, the formation of this group, the premise of it was, let's go out, use our wealth and our education to uplift, to raise the standard of living of poor Jews where we can find them.
Sure.
And it became a kind of education outreach. Let's go build schools. Let's go get clean water. Specifically for our people who are often disincluded in,
or excluded, to coin a phrase.
Excluded, right. But
the word disincluded is good, but I'm going to propose a new word, excluded.
but I think, and I don't even know if disincluded is a word, but I'm trying to get at the subtle difference between specifically excluded versus sort of passively disincluded.
Right. Not getting a lot of the benefits that are coming with modernity and the new comfort and affluence.
And the leader of the Alliance Israelite Universelle was a man named Adolf Cremieux, and he was also a Freemason.
Here we go.
And there was during the French Revolution, which was the first kind of instance of like a kind of confusion about how, what are the, all these forces that are at work here? There, it was the introduction of the idea that there was maybe a Jewish Masonic conspiracy that again was sort of predicated on control through manipulation.
A secret group we don't know about.
Right.
Operating in plain sight, but at the highest levels.
That's accomplishing goals not by brute force, but by infiltration, mm-hmm. by blackmail, by...
All these means that are invisible and therefore, you know, plausible as a story.
Now, weirdly, Crémieux and his AIU go out and are... I think by the standards of the time, doing great work, you know, going to places and really helping raise the living standard, and also imparting a proud identity to people that had been living kind of on the fringe of wherever it was they were living. And if you think about North Africa and Arabia and Palestine throughout this whole period, Jews and Arabs lived peacefully side by side for centuries.
Sure.
And there was not a sense of...
Yeah, nothing was stoking.
No, there was no... There
resentment.
There wasn't religious hatred. There wasn't a feeling... I mean, there was a feeling that these were religions of Abraham, and the Jews and their Arabs were all more or less sort of Semitic people.
There's a limited kind of pluralism that's working to keep these communities operating and running peacefully with each other.
Right. And the Ottoman territories had always been, you know, as long as you paid your taxes within the Ottoman Empire, they kind of didn't really care what religion you practiced. And so the introduction of these French Jews into these communities, trying to, you know, develop a Jewish identity and to spread this a new kind of method of education, an enlightenment-based education system.
And a higher standard of living, probably.
It actually sort of sowed the seeds, inserted a wedge, I guess, between the Jews and their Arab Muslim neighbors, where...
Hey, some of us are getting money pouring in from Paris.
Right.
And some of us are not.
In particular, portions of North Africa and the Levant that were laboring under French colonialism.
Oh, right.
That although the Jews were their ancient neighbors, as the Jews started to receive the benefits of French education, which ultimately the education system that the Alliance was bringing to North Africa, for instance, was basically a French system, not a Jewish one.
So it very much looks like the hand and face of imperialism,
right,
reaching in.
And suddenly the Jews of these nations started to be regarded as pieds noirs, yeah, as foreigners and interlopers, even though they were ancient populations.
Because of their associations with the new colonizers.
That's right. But also during this period, there was a movement within Judaism, still a lot of people who thought that the future was to assimilate into Germany, into France, into Russia, assimilate, you know, to become prosperous and to, in some cases, end up with titles. You know, the Rothschilds became barons. I mean, to mm-hmm. become integrated populations rather than always being thought of as other. And within that, there were movements to convert. A lot of people did convert. This we saw later during the Holocaust.
Converting to Christianity. For status reasons?
Well, for status reasons. I mean, during the period in Spain where... The Inquisition,
killing Jews.
There were a lot of Jews that were forcibly converted that continued to kind of practice Judaism on the sly. But a lot of Jews did convert to Catholicism in order to keep their...
I mean, on the sly, you know, every generation, it might diminish a little, you know?
Right. Hard to remember why it is that we keep a menorah here. Granddad found it at a flea market or whatever. Right. There were a couple of key players in this whole story that wrote influential books in the mid 19th century. There was a book called The International Jewish Conspiracy, which was written by a man named Jacob Bronfman, who was a Jew who converted to Christianity.
Oh, and then to curry favor with his new buddies.
Wrote this book, again, kind of cribbing from a lot of this source material.
The title's a little on the nose. Yeah, hey, right. Jacob, what's your book about the International Jewish Conspiracy called?
The International Jewish Conspiracy? There was, in 1878, a book was written by a man named Osman Bey, which sounds like a Turkish name.
Yes.
But his real name was Frederick Millingen, and he was a Dutch Jew who
Osman Bey is what Justin Trudeau calls himself when he's wearing his Arabian face.
He went, Millingen went to Turkey and joined the army and fought for the Ottomans and converted to Islam.
Huh.
And then converted to Orthodoxy and wrote a book called The Conquest of the World by Jews. Again, a kind of, it's the old trope of the self-hating Jew.
There must be some external pressure on these guys, right? These guys aren't just thinking of this. Somebody is like, hey, you were a Jew, right? Tell us all the secret stuff you guys are up to.
Or a feeling like this is, if I'm going to truly assimilate here, I need to denounce my people in the most sensationalistic way possible.
Yeah, maybe he's still getting accused. We can't trust this guy. He's still a Jew. Look at him, Well, not after you read this.
All of this coalesced at the very end of the 19th century the beginning of the 20th with the original publication of what became the Protocols of the Meetings of the Learned Elders of Zion.
It's a little long.
It is a little long.
The Ladies of the Harem of the Court of King Caractacus.
When it was first published, it was just sort of a small pamphlet and a pamphlet that was very much derived from the original sort of Maurice Joly satirical version of this conversation.
As uploaded into Biarritz.
As run through Biarritz and the writings of Hermann Goetze. Now it was taken completely out of either of those contexts, published as a slim volume that purported to be the overheard conversation that happened in a once every 100-year meeting.
Ooh.
of the leaders of all the 12 tribes of Israel who all would meet in Paris and discuss once every 100 years how their project, their centuries old project
for world domination
was going.
I suspect, so I've never read the Protocols, and I suspect I'm not going to be a fan. I'm not going to recommend it to my book club. But I got to say, I enjoy the world building here.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to write one of these awful anti-Semitic tracts or screeds, like I kind of like the idea that he's going to invent this imaginary Congress that has once every 100 years and somehow we snuck out the minutes.
It's wonderful the way like a lot of these stories, it's a great world building, but the key element, like how did you...
That's what I was going to say.
If this meeting's happening every 100 years and it's like the most closely guarded secret, how did someone like a janitor overhear this?
And there's no purported explanation for its provenance, right? Nobody waves their hands and says, here's how many Bothans died to bring us this information.
There is. Oh. One of the explanations was that a woman who knew one of the top Masonic leaders got her hands on this. And I think that's believable because it was like a bedside.
There's some sexual element, that's like right. Some Mata Hari type spiriting out of his
loose lips sink ships
hotel suite.
Another one was that they found someone found this book. They pushed on a bookshelf and they were led into the Chancellery of Zion, and there it was, and they grabbed it and ran out.
I don't think if Zion has a secret chancellery, it should be better guarded than that.
What's crazy about it is, there is no, in all the years since 1902, of course, there have been innumerable attempts to explain who wrote this document and where it came from. And no one has ever, I mean, all the great scholars, all of the interested parties.
This is actual study of its real provenance.
Yeah.
And we don't know.
Have never been able to discern exactly what happened. Now the,
it just appeared.
The characters in this little passion play are a man by the name of Pyotr Rachovsky, who was the head of the Okhrana, which was the Tsarist secret police.
Oh, like and KGB of the early
KGB of the
turn
Tsar.
Of the century.
And he's trying to stoke anti-Semitism as a way of, you know, as a kind of Bismarckian way of keeping politics under his thumb.
Is this like later the same purpose it would serve for the Nazis? Is it a scapegoat? Don't blame the Tsar. Blame the Jews for whatever's wrong with your life?
Yeah, it was. I mean, there were within the global competition that was now taking place between Russia and Prussia and I keep saying Germany, but Prussia and you know Austria and France. Whenever someone would get the short end of the stick in some conflict, it was a lot easier to say, well, we were undermined than it was to say, well, we did a bad job.
Right.
Our generals did a bad job. The Tsar is not the smartest leader. We're not, you know, we didn't have a good claim to that.
They should just go with the American explanation, which is we actually won.
We won. Right. They should have.
Despite what you've heard about Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
And they did.
They all went great.
They did that too. The presence of this protocol was not just anti-Semitic, but it was anti-liberalism.
Ah.
Right? The Tsar is not feeling pressure from the Jews. The Tsar is feeling pressure from modernity and reform.
Forces of democracy and reform.
That's right.
And this would scare people away from that, right?
If you can make the case that democracy and reform are actually pernicious. The end goal is not to give you more freedom, is not to give the world more liberty and more right. economic opportunity.
The more autocratic the Tsar remains, then the safer we are from this kind of stuff I'm reading about in my new protocol.
That's right. He's saving you from liberalism. And connecting it to the Jews is just, in a way, kind of a convenient happenstance.
You could fill in the blank today with the deep state and the president. You
exactly.
know? As long as he's doing all this crazy stuff, he's keeping us safe from these conspiracies.
Well, and the idea that we see in the way we talk about the way the Russians intervened in our last election, it's very, very similar to the way that the Jews were described in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Does that make you skeptical of these claims?
It's all very, very, very familiar.
It really is.
The idea, and also Russia being an Asiatic other.
The villain that people that the right age to believe this kind of stuff remember their whole lives, right?
Right. And primarily that the work that was being done by the Russians on Facebook or by the Jews in Russia in 1902 does not have a direct end, but has an indirect end, which is to destabilize and ultimately like undermine long functioning systems and replace them with the unknown with
it's a smart bet because chaos tends to increase in a system.
That's right.
You don't have to predict a particular outcome for your conspiracy to take off. You can be like, hey, anything weird that happens coming up is clearly part of this destabilization attempt. So it's very forward compatible with no matter what happens.
And connecting it to the Jews made it seem that much more dangerous because the Jews were this sort of very, very present other. And the idea that they would be trying to gain control, not just over their local government, but globally, it equated with the rise of a kind of Jewish self-awareness and sense that wealthy and powerful Jews needed to look out for Jews globally.
There is increasing affluence and influence. Yeah,
that's right. It connected to a sort of very recent in the last 100 years, complete destabilization of Europe and you know, liberalism didn't sweep in as one single movement. It happened in different places in different times, and it was, and there was a lot of bloodshed that went along with it.
Well, I'm not convinced. You're trying to convince me, but I'm still against this book, John. I think it's bull.
So this became, and of course we cannot attribute this book to Rachowski and what Rachowski did. And this is, there's been so much scholarship and investigation about where this came from. Rachowski took made dupes of other writers, feeding all of this, all of these writings that were, you know, the font of these secret meetings.
Dream this up. He never had a bunch of guys sit around and be like, let's say they're called the Elders of Zion, but he found some of this literature out there in the ether and kind of combined it into a thing and a movement.
Yeah. And there were, you know, there were things that were easy to grab, right? I mean, the Jews had independent governments within their other nations because
some autonomy, and
they had to be self-directing because they, you know, they needed to be organized.
Right.
And so they had an idea, or I guess a system called Kahal, which was like a theocratic kind of.
So they had a parallel kind of justice system administered by religious leaders?
Yeah, and it was easy to, it was easy. I mean, that's like Kahal is a pretty sinister sounding idea.
Like today in the US, the word Sharia uses that, it fulfills that same niche. Like, better watch out, they're using a Sharia system in Ann Arbor, Michigan or something.
Right.
Scaremongering.
Scaremongering and just sort of like, we don't know what this is, so.
It sounds weird.
It sounds weird. It sounds bad. There was a Russian aristocrat who was kind of a playboy who fell on hard times and hit and got a sort of had an Orthodox religious conversion by the name of Sergei Nilis, who was writing sort of mystical writings about his own Orthodox transformation.
I see, his conversion.
And he wrote a book called, and this whole era is defined by books that have really long titles, but his book was, or his influential book was called The Great Within the Small and Antichrist, An Imminent Political Possibility, Notes of an Orthodox Believer.
I can't diagram that sentence.
And within
the Great Within the Small and Antichrist? Is the Great Within the Antichrist?
The Great Within the Small and Antichrist.
Okay, I have no idea. Okay.
And within his book, the final chapter of his book is also kind of this pamphlet that became the first Elders of the Protocols of Zion pamphlet that then was expanded upon and taken out of any kind of like, this is a received transmission. This is a story or a dialogue, right, between characters.
All the framing is gone, and it's as if it's really just a first person.
And it becomes this account. And then it is expanded upon. It's originally published in 1902. Then we see in Russian, and we see increasing in Russian, but kind of clearly a Russian translation of original French text.
Okay.
And then we start to see it disseminate as a translation out of the Russian.
Just like an onion piece. Man, and then pretty soon you start seeing it, you know, the Daily Caller falls for it or whatever.
Right. Henry Ford paid for a translation of it that he called The International Jew, and he, in the 20s, printed 500,000 copies of it.
And he's very influential with all his employees.
With his employees, and he was thought of as the one of those great American industrialists.
If Henry Ford is worried about this, maybe we should be worried, honey.
Our old pal, Father Coughlin.
The radio demagogue.
Yeah, published and I think read aloud from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion quite a bit. It became then, after World War I, so at the beginning of World War I, the Pale of Settlement dissolved, and Jews at that point were able to kind of escape, travel freely for a brief period there, because there was no longer, those old restrictions didn't apply as the as these empires started to crumble.
There's new boundary lines anyway, right?
Yeah. Reportedly, Tsar Nicholas, after he was deposed by the Bolsheviks, read aloud from the protocols of the Elders of Xylon to his family from a Bolshevik jail prior to them being taken out and shot and buried in a hole.
Is that why they shot the Romanovs? Just to shut him up?
No, I think it was, I mean, they shot him because he was a bad czar and well, they were Bolsheviks.
There is that, I guess.
but you could see that he was telling this story to his family by way of explanation.
This explains our plight. Well, that's the question I was going to ask. Was this just fooling the masses, or were people in power, were they falling for it too? Or were they just using this like, hey, this will be great for us? Or was it really more like, holy cow, we were right about the Jews. Guys, check this out.
The idea, for instance, the Germans at the end of World War I had very rightly a lot of confusion about how it is they ended up having lost, in the sense that on the final days of the war, the Germans had not really surrendered any territory. They hadn't really lost any battles. You know, it had been a truce for the whole length of the war. It was only the introduction of the United States that started to tip the scales. If the U.S. hadn't joined the war there at the very end, there was the British and French never would have defeated the Germans.
So they're just feeling disbelief. They're like, no, we were doing great. Something must have.
Up until I think even at the conclusion of the war,
they're all like, okay, the war's over. We won, right?
Well, or from the German perspective, it was like, all right, well, that sucked. Let's all shake hands and go back and go back to our farms. And it was then in the post-war treaty process that France in particular, really prosecuted their victory and imposed all these incredible treaties on the Germans and the Austrians. They completely partitioned Austria. Hungary became a shadow of its former self. And in that Treaty of Versailles process, the Germans kind of came out the other side like, wait a minute, what happened? How did this happen? And at this point, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion suggested this very kind of convincing argument that the Germans had been undermined from within. They were the military power. They had this Teutonic structure. How could we have failed? How could it have failed
us? The deck was unfairly stacked against them by shadowy, sinister forces.
That's right. Also, a lot of whom are located in Paris as part of this. And, you know, this is also post-Dreyfus affair within France, where, you know, the French Republic was kind of rent asunder by the idea that a Jewish officer had spied on behalf of the Germans and had been discovered and prosecuted, even though he was a scapegoat and it was really a completely different officer who was sort of Hungarian.
It's a very divisive thing, and you could really see who was buying the story based on the Jewish identity of the purported traitor, right?
If you look at the people within France who supported Dreyfus, they were all the intellectuals and artists and ballet dancers, and
that was not enough.
And the, you know, people that were Republican and were pro-government, pro-military, of course, all, in spite of all the evidence that Dreyfus was innocent, insisted on his guilt. So there was even within the competitors, the governmental competitors of these different nations, there was a kind of unified sense that within our own nations, there are Jews working against us in favor of their global desire to undermine
all our Jewish institutions.
That's right.
And there's no inquiry of this at any high level. It's an obvious forgery, I assume, on many levels.
So,
and nobody's doing that work?
In the 1930s, there was, within Switzerland, in the city of Bern, a group of like affluent Jews sued a publisher of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion under the law that the publication was sowing hatred, and there were anti-hatred laws even then. And so throughout the 1930s, there was an ongoing series of court cases in Switzerland where over and over all the evidence was presented that these were forgeries, that this was a that this was the work of the Russian intelligence service. That
presumably
was,
if they'd been true, that would have been a good defense. I assume in this era as now, truth isn't pretty absolute defense against libel. So if this actually is a real group's meeting minutes, then the court's going to decide one way. And if they're a fraud, that's pretty relevant.
Yeah, and but there's no convincing you if you think that the courts are also
sure
part of a overarching Jewish conspiracy.
How did the findings go? Like, were officials generally on board with, yeah, this is probably a hoax, but it just didn't convince the masses?
Well, because this was also, 1935, 33 to 36 or whatever, was also the rise of the Third Reich. And Hitler referred to the protocols in Mein Kampf. They were widely publicized, or rather widely published and disseminated within Nazi Germany as
explanations for the new policies.
Well, and as a true document. And so, although within the Swiss courts, it was adjudicated, I think, that all of the proof that these were forgeries had been aptly demonstrated or amply demonstrated.
But that was not getting to your average Bavarian.
No, because you could never find the author. Mm-hmm. No one ever stood up and said, I wrote them. It was a party trick. Because it had so many authors and there were so many sort of wellsprings of it. But also,
it's funny that there was no actual conspiracy really to produce it. It was kind of an organic collage of different things that made this awful document.
Because what made it so appealing was not that it wasn't that the Jews were trying to control the world. It was an explanatory text for how come the world is what it is. Mm-hmm. And it made the scapegoat the liberal impulse. I think a lot of people mistakenly think that Hitler and the Nazis thought of the Jews as lesser and subhuman because that was what they said to the...
That's what the propaganda said.
To the masses to justify killing them.
But they were like using animals. Them just like the Tsar.
And the Nazis, I think, philosophically believed that the Jews were dangerously smart, dangerously powerful, and were trying to undermine what was a good German, maybe a stolid Germanness that wasn't smart, that didn't listen to avant-garde music, that didn't appreciate modernist painting. And those were good things. That the idea that Picasso was turning German teenagers into degenerates as part of a Jewish plan to institute democratic jazz music government in such a way that, that ultimately the destabilization.
When I hear the word culture, I reach for my Browning, right?
Like, right. Well, there's Kultur and then there's culture jazz hands.
Yeah.
So although the protocols have been demonstrated to be frauds since 6 weeks after they were first published, and of course incredibly discredited throughout the whole of the 20th century, the protocols of the Elders of Zion are cited in the foundation documents of Hamas. Hmm. And they are now widely printed and disseminated as true documents within the Arab world.
What about in the West? Like, do you still see white supremacist, neo-Nazi type groups relying on this kind of language?
You do, but within the West, it has become, there's an awful lot of assimilation of these ideas and these terms into the broader global sort of world of conspiracy thinking. Conspiracy theory in the United States right now is a extremely seductive and powerful cultural movement.
It's probably at an all-time high just due to technology, if
people
nothing else.
People love it, and they look for it everywhere. And 9/11 was a conspiracy.
Something as benign as the vaccine you give your kids become and a huge battleground.
Liberal progressives are just as susceptible to conspiracy thinking as reactionary conservatives. There's a conspiracy to fit every mood. And so many of them are rooted in an idea from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is that the world is not what it appears. It is ideas that seem to be liberal are actually being used to destabilize, undermine, corrupt.
Yeah, any kind of reform, seemingly progressive reform, is actually a con. Right,
right. And that by corrupting us, by making us slaves to consumerism, to capitalism. I mean, capitalism was, throughout this whole period, another dog whistle for the Jews. And now we see on the left in America, there's no greater enemy than capitalism. And a lot of that anti-Semitic language has just been whitewashed of its anti-Semitism. But the idea still that there is there's somewhere a big meeting room.
Shadowy rich guys.
Full of rich guys who, you know, we're not calling them Jews anymore because they could be anybody, but mostly Jews.
If you're conservative, you could say Soros. You could mention particular Jewish influencers and wink a bit.
But it's across the political spectrum.
Yeah.
And so the...
It informs some criticism of Israel on the left. I mean...
There's a tremendous...
There's certainly valid and invalid criticism of Israel, but sometimes it's informed by these ideas.
Well, and within that world of... there are a lot of people that feel like any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, but there's also... a sense that anyone who says that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic is also part of a different is also anti-Semitic.
Yeah, right. I don't want to diagram that sentence either.
So although the protocols now, you would not find any reputable citation of them. Except in the like basest white supremacy community, you would never hear them taken seriously. But
now they're just baked into the culture. You almost don't have to cite them.
It's baked into the culture, and now with the involvement of the Russians as the latest agents of destabilizing forces, the lack of any concrete sense of truth, we're all living in a world described by the Protocols of Zion.
It seems like the story of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is broader than what I would have thought of it as, which is kind of a landmark of anti-Semitic thought. It is that, but it's also just a wider movement of sowing distrust in all of our institutions.
Yeah, when you hear someone say the Jews control the media, it's not just an indictment of the Jews. It's attempting to be an indictment of the media.
Don't trust any of this. It's been infiltrated.
That's right. And it's not just that the Jews are controlling the media to benefit themselves. It's that by making the media untrustworthy, the Jews are ultimately trying to destroy civilization and put it under their thumb. So it really, the Jews are the culprits in that story, but really the goal is to make you feel like you can't trust anyone.
Well, that's still how I feel when I look at the sound meter on the Jumbotron, so it must be working.
Well, Ken, you can trust me.
And that concludes The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, entry 1000.ES0905, certificate number 42869, in the omnibus. Speaking of forces of destabilization and chaos, please seek us out on social media. We are at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick on Twitter and in John's case, Instagram. We are at Omnibus Project, everywhere you look. We're not sowing societal chaos.
Are we not, though?
You're
part of the global Mormon conspiracy to...
I'm not doing a very good job.
To put marshmallows in Jell-O.
It's going great, by the way.
I'm part of the
marshmallow sales are up 0.2% this holiday season, and I think a lot of that's me.
I'm part of the global conspiracy that insists on still not wearing socks even in winter.
I'm in the global conspiracy to make it okay to take off your shoes on an airplane.
No!
And I know
I will fight you.
You can't fight me. The flight attendants will support me in this.
Why don't you bring your fucking support turkey? Oh, I'm sorry. I swore there.
they didn't hear. They bleeped it. Mark bleeped it. Nobody heard that. Nobody even knows what word you said. You could have said something nice about my support turkey, which you should.
Your awesome support turkey.
Because Caroline is delightful and very well behaved on most flights.
I do not want to sit next to your turkey.
If you would like to send us any kind of physical item through the mails.
Oh, what do you got there?
It's a postcard from Hawaii. Oh, this is the guy that sent us this. This is from the guy that sent us the snacks.
Oh, yeah. Those are good snacks.
Here's somebody writing from Burning Man.
Hey!
And wants us to put Burning Man in the omnibus. I'm amazed that he had the wherewithal at Burning Man to think about podcast.
You know, there are as many Burning Men as there are Burning Mans.
I'm not sure what that means. The great and small within the small at Burning Man.
There are people at Burning Man who are not high, is what I'm trying to say.
Here's our friend Sparky writing us from Boston. He just sends us a postcard wherever he goes.
Hey, Sparky.
It's two teddy bears carrying a thing of baked beans, which is something you often see walking around Boston.
Yeah, but look more carefully. You see Masonic symbols all over that.
Oh, obviously.
So, anyway.
Look how the bears are kind of marching in a military fashion. I don't know. Are those kosher beans?
Saddam Hussein, basically.
Here's a homemade postcard in which someone has grammatically diagrammed the sentence, "We hope and pray the catastrophe we fear may never come."
Oh, I love that.
So now we know how to diagram that sentence.
Please, 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 futurelings, if you're going to send us something and you want to diagram some sentences on a postcard, we are the target audience for that.
Write out your letter and then send us a second letter in which you diagram the sentences of your first letter.
You would be amazed at the number of offline conversations Ken and I have where one of us says, "Boy, I don't want to diagram that sentence." And Ken says it online four times an episode.
You can send any of these things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155, if the mails are working in your era. It's probably a Kevin Costner type postman wandering the wasteland, but he'll deliver to us, I'm sure. He seems like a good guy. If you have currency in your era, if you would like to ensure the long-term success of this entry, we really want to cover all of human culture, and it's a little bit daunting. There's new culture every time I look. We have not done a show about Visco Girls, and suddenly there's Visco Girls.
This show doesn't seem like it's a lot of work. It just seems like me and Ken sitting and talking about all the stuff we normally would, which it is.
But instead, it's me checking my email while John reads about anti-Semitic literature for 2 hours.
I was so mad. I was so mad looking over at you, looking at your phone while I'm telling you some important stuff.
I was taking notes on my phone. I'm using my notes app to write down important information about the Elders of Zion.
Good.
Every 100 years, check. And
actually, wait a minute. That would have meant that the latest protocols meeting happened in 2002 or something. Why the heck didn't we?
Why weren't we invited?
Come on.
Where do you think it was? Do you think there was a bidding process of who gets to host the Elders of Zion?
What was going on in 2002? Well, it was post 9/11.
Just.
So we were busy. We were busy making the world safe for democracy.
We were busy renaming French fries.
Yeah, they were probably in Zurich or something.
We didn't even notice. Yeah. Why was I talking about this? Oh, so if you want to donate to become a contributor to the omnibus and ensure the long-term health of the project as culture booms, please use our Patreon, patreon.com/omnibus. The Burning Omnibus. Omnibus Project, but without the H.
Omnibabushka.
There's a Facebook group. It's the only place on Facebook where you won't see awful fake news sown by the Russians, those sinister agents of chaos. Would be the Futurelings Facebook group. It's delightful. Please join. There are similar gathering places on Reddit. John said all the names last time, and I wasn't listening. Mm-hmm. I was looking at my phone.
That's right.
So I don't know what they were.
r/Futurelings, I think, is the one that I'm going to go with.
Oh, you've chosen a dog in the race.
I don't know.
The other two are gonna wither on the vine now.
I don't know. That just seems pretty bold. r/omnibus_futurelings.
There's no official subreddit that we both endorse. We enjoy let a thousand flowers bloom on Reddit.
r/futurelings, I feel like if we're going to just reduce it to one, let's just call it that.
But there was also Omnibus Project and omnibus_futurelings.
That's right.
So a lot of options out there for you to waste your time.
Someone else solve this because I don't want to. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Almost certainly it was undermined by liberalism.
Will the elders of Zion meet again in 2102? Hard to say.
I think that modern art and jazz music probably turned us all into degenerates, and now we're just living squalid lives crawling around in the muck.
I never listened to jazz or went to the ballet. Am I still a degenerate? Has modern art got its tendrils in me other ways?
I know a lot of degenerates, and you, sir, are no degenerate.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
No. I feel like you're upholding, you're going to be the last man standing. The last person in a Madras short-sleeved button-down shirt standing.
Listening to Vivaldi.
We hope and pray that liberalism is not a pernicious divider of people, but one that brings light onto the world. But if the worst comes soon, and we are wrong this whole time, and it really was like the modern novel that lit the fuse.
If that's true, then this episode will be censored by our future overlords. No one will ever hear this entry in the omnibus.
If that's true, then this recording, unlike all our other recordings, may not make it to your ears. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the omnibus.